From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for June 26, 2020. Just a heads up. With all the cancellations, you might think nothing is happening in town, but you'd be wrong. Next week, throughout southeastern Wisconsin, the sky is gonna light up with fireworks. Just check your local municipality for date and time. We're all familiar with these parks, Yellowstone, Glacier, Yosemite. Well, the state of Oregon has a new park right on the coast. Back in 1970, on that very spot, a 45-foot, 8-ton whale washed up on shore. And the accepted way of disposing of a whale carcass was, well, blow it up. Who knew? After nearly 50 years, the town asked the public for naming suggestions. And that's always a bad idea. Well, the public have spoken. Welcome to Exploding Whale Memorial Park. Alcohol sales have been booming during the lockdown, but things have taken a downward turn. Many airlines across the globe are discontinuing drink service, even in first class. So, I guess if you want a drink, you'll just have to drive. Speaking of drinking and driving, which you obviously shouldn't do ever, a Texas State University co-ed didn't listen to my advice and was arrested for driving under the influence. The interesting part of the story is what she was driving. It was a battery-powered, hot pink Barbie Jeep. And it gets a little weirder. The arresting officer's first name is Ken. He'll tell that story for the rest of his life. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kilb, Steve Giles, Joel Dreesing, and looking back at the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Jason. A rough week for the markets this week with some resurging news on COVID cases. The S&P for the week down 2.9%, the NASDAQ down 1.9%. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average losing 730 points today to close the week, down 3.3%. At the bell today, the Dow closed at 25,015. For the week, obviously, I think resurgence. Joel, as you mentioned in our emails back and forth before, we kicked off the show today, resurgence seems to be the word of the week. Clearly, seeing signs, at least from some data looking back at the economy, that maybe we're seeing a resurgence in certain indicators. And then at the same time, I think this week we've seen a resurgence in cases. And so, normally we don't jump right into the economic data, but I think we're seeing some good news there. And at the same time, it might be in contrast to some of the other data that we're seeing in other places. So anything in particular from the economic stuff, Joel, that stood out to you this week?
Yeah, Kyle. And, whenever we look at these numbers, I always try to remind everyone that it's just 1 month. So, from 1 month to the next, especially now, a lot is going on. We had some good indications this week on new home sales, on durable goods orders, on personal spending, on consumer sentiment. Personal spending went up a record amount in the month of May, 8.2%. But that was after, let me look at my numbers here, that was after falling like $2.9 trillion or 20% from the peak in February. So that 8.2 is important, and that's heading in the right direction. But we're still, it means that we're spending about as much as we did 3 years ago. With all of the shelter in place, shutting the economy down for a couple of months, we have this huge hole to dig out of, and we're starting to see indications in various areas that we are climbing out of the hole. But again, that's 1 month, and we're not sure how that's going to be revised, and we're not sure what the next month is going to look like. I mentioned consumer sentiment. That's a number that I look at a lot. Comes out twice a month from the University of Michigan. They've been doing this survey for, I think they started in the 1960s. But the economist who does that a couple of months ago pointed out how, sentiment went way, way down, and said that, he expected it to go down, and consumer sentiment leads into consumer spending, which drives 70% of our economy. So it's very important, but it's also very fickle. And this economist said, you know, this is going to come back up again when we reopen the economy, when people feel confident about going out and spending money, which is something that is talked a lot on this podcast. You know, when they're feeling better about that, then that sentiment is going to go back up again. And it did go up. It went up for the second month in a row in June. But he pointed out that, this is a couple of months ago, pointed out that worse than the economy shutting down would be if it shuts down and then it opens back up and then it shuts down again. And with that resurgence in COVID cases, that's something that you're starting to fear. I mean, you're seeing some states, you know, put things in place that they already took off the table. I think a good example is Apple. You know, Apple, we talked last week, shut down, what, 11 stores in four states, and today they're adding 21 more. So, you know, so it's not just a government doing it, it's a business saying this is something that we don't want to be a part of right now.
And Joel, bars and restaurants in Florida and Texas now being closed again as well. And I think, you know, it gets to the thing that we've been talking about, you know, even before this pandemic began, which is that you don't see markets fall apart. You don't see the economy fall apart because of one piece of bad news. What happens is you have a crisis of confidence. And I think what that economist from the University of Michigan was getting at is that, you know, if we close the economy because of the pandemic and then we reopen it and it stays open, people trust that the health experts out there have things under control. They trust that we're headed back in the right direction. And if you get to the point where we're at right now, where you have a resurgence in cases, where you have the need to close businesses back down as Apple is doing, or bars and restaurants as certain states are doing, I think you start to question whether or not we really have this under control and what it's going to take to get it under control. And you have a bigger crisis of confidence than you ever would have had in the first place. And so, you know, I think that just speaks to the next time we say, okay, we can open up again, we can allow things to move a little more freely. You know, are people going to be as eager to rush back out and do that as they were the first time? And so, you know, I think this all gets back to virus counts. It all gets back to case counts, and it's nothing, you know, obviously not more evident than what we saw this week, you know, today with the markets falling apart as Texas and Florida announced that. And so, you know, I think you look at the challenges that this virus presents, you look at kind of what that means for the economy. And it meant that when we thought that maybe the recovery was going to go a little bit smoother on June 8th, we had a pretty significant rally in stocks, and it's turning out to be a pretty good quarter for stocks as well. But now that we're starting to see a bit of a resurgence, you've got stocks selling back off again. And it's what we talked about, certainly. You know, Brian, Steve, we've had you both on the podcast over the last couple of weeks to talk about the fact that just because markets have rallied, it doesn't mean this is over. And, you know, I think we kind of jumped right into economic numbers today. But, you know, Brian, I think we've got plenty to talk about in terms of case counts and plenty to talk about in terms of what that means for the market.
You know, Kyle, I got a bunch of thoughts about that. First of all, I think it's kind of silly to think that as we started to relax some of the more stringent rules, and as people started to go back into whatever the new normal may be, that case counts wouldn't start to spike a little bit. I mean, common sense would tell you the more people that are back and mingling and doing things publicly, the more case counts you're going to have. So I always kind of find it interesting when the market reacts to things that presumably common sense would have dictated would have happened anyway. I think the other part of the news, maybe the good part of the news, would be that states are reacting quickly. And I think this was never going to be kind of a linear response to something as big and as unknowing as this virus. It was going to be, hey, different people are going to try different things. Some things are going to work better than others. Some people are going to go faster than others. I'm actually pretty encouraged to see that as cases have spiked in certain places, that for the most part, those places have taken quick responses to it. So I also think you have to go back to the beginning and keep things in context in terms of, as this whole thing unfolded, and you think back 3 or 4 months ago, our expectation was, I believe at the time, that if this thing got as bad as we thought it might, our hope would be to flatten the curve, right? We don't even talk about that expression anymore, but to make sure that we smooth it out enough that we would do whatever we can to make sure the load on hospitals and critical care was sufficient to cover those in need. And that so far has certainly been accomplished. And so now, it isn't a matter that the goal is changing and the context is changing. I don't know, but I do think it would be difficult for me to not have expected this to happen, I guess. You know, then on the economic side, I would say, we've talked a lot about U-shape and V-shape recoveries and how quick is this thing going to be. I think for me, I'm encouraged in the short run that things have picked up. Joel, as you referred to earlier, and that people are getting back to certain things quicker. I do think perhaps the more important long-term question is how much will things come back, you know, and where will we all end up shaking out? What has really been lost in the process long-term? And I was thinking today about maybe you guys saw an article by Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal about baseball. You know, I'm a huge baseball fan, and they're going to play 60 games now. We should celebrate that. But his question was, what if we found out that 60 games was enough, right? What if we found out that, hey, you know what? Maybe even for the baseball lovers like me, that 162 games was excessive, and maybe we shouldn't be wearing snow gloves in the middle of the World Series anymore. And that's what I wonder, you guys, is how might our perceptions and behavior patterns and perhaps retail sales as a result change in the long run? And could it be that our buying patterns will be modified permanently? And what would be the positive repercussions of that and the negative repercussions of that as we move forward? And I think that's kind of where my head's at these days, trying to give some of those things consideration in terms of who are going to be the winners and who are going to be the losers in a scenario that plays out that way.
Well, Brian, and I also think it's interesting that you bring up the time horizon, because a lot of people that I talk about seem to only be worried about the week ahead and where we're going. And I have to remind everybody that they're invested for the rest of their lives. And that could be 30, 40, 50 years for some people. And so when you talk about a long-term investment and where a stock's going to be in the long term, I mean, we're all thinking for the most part 5, 10, 15 years from now. Obviously, living through what we're living through now, the uncertainty that each day brings can be unsettling for a lot of investors.
You know, Steve, I think that's such a good point. And Brian, you mentioned, you know, kind of the changing landscape, and what if 60 games is enough for baseball? And what if we decide the two preseason games for football is enough? And yeah, it's funny to joke about sports because it's a game. But the reality is this is changing the way that people shop. It's changing where people shop. It's changing how people travel. And all of these changes provide an immense amount of pain to the people that it impacts directly, but it also provides opportunity. And so you look at, you know, the stores that are going out of business, for example, Hertz and JCPenney's and GNC, maybe not going out of business, but certainly going through bankruptcy and potentially looking very different when they come through. And at the same time, you have all these stores doing that. Many of these stores have been on lists of likely bankruptcy candidates for years. And so I think some of what we're seeing isn't simply a changing landscape. It's an escalation of what we've been talking about for years, a move online, or you know, a move towards new experiences rather than, you know, the way things used to be done. And so, you know, I'm sensitive to, I think, that the amount of people that have been impacted. You know, you see in the travel industry, more than 8 million people have lost their jobs. That's a significant number of people that are out of work that, you know, for many of them may not come back because we're going to need to travel less, or because, you know, we just maybe don't want to travel as much as we did. And so, you know, I think that's a big deal. But at the same time, it also means that our economy is going to change. The ways that we derive, you know, the gross domestic product, they have to change. And this all necessitates that. And so, you know, I think as we look at what this means, not just for Steve, as you say, the next week, but as we look at what this means for, you know, the years down the road, it's a very different environment.
You know, Kyle, I wonder if you considered for a minute that, and again, we could do this literally forever here, but if you just speculated and looked ahead and said, perhaps at the end of the day, we'll spend less money, And let's go back to our example. If we play 140 games and everybody get paid for 140 games, and we buy 140 games worth of hot dogs and beers instead of 160, what is the overall impact on the economy? I think one of the other interesting things that's happened in the last 4 months, as you guys know, is the savings rate's just gone berserk, you know? And if part of the trade-off for consumer spending is that people save a little bit more and take care of their own personal balance sheets a little bit more, certainly might have some ramifications in the short run, but it doesn't have to be a bad thing in the long run, you know, because there are some long-term bigger problems to solve in terms of federal deficits and things, and we're going to have to balance things out that way, and maybe that's one of the ways this plays out, but certainly it's going to be interesting to see how it does play out in the months and years ahead.
Brian, getting back to some of the economic data, I mean, that's a good point, because we entered this recession. I mean, a lot of the numbers that we're looking at were hitting series highs, like back in January and February. And to, you know, to be set back 10 years and or sometimes longer, and now, you know, to be coming out of that, I mean, that speaks well to the potential that's there for, you know, for recovery.
You know, I think one of the other things, Kyle, you and I kind of exchanged some notes on this before too, but I think one of the other things that's kind of interesting is something you just touched on. And, you know, if you go to a company like Macy's or Hertz or some of the guys that were not doing so well to begin with, you know, has COVID pushed them into bankruptcy, or was bankruptcy an inevitable thing that got accelerated because of COVID? And I think there's a huge difference there. You know, if the events that have occurred in the last few months have driven an acceleration of more online buying, or, you know, in some cases, less car rentals or whatever it might be, and that outcome was inevitable, then in the long run, we aren't more damaged, perhaps. We're more strengthened by, you know, kind of the idea that capitalism is kind of taking care of its own problems to some degree. And I think that's where the conversation for me then goes back to the Fed and what the Fed's doing. How much money are they pouring into it? And how much of that money is good money versus money that might be, you know, as the old expression is, throwing good money after bad, you know?
Well, Brian, I think that's a great point. And certainly we've thrown a lot of bad money at this problem. But I think that the challenge that we've talked about for so long is that in the moment, it's really difficult to know what's going to work and what isn't going to work. And the impact of things like Fed stimulus isn't necessarily immediately felt. And so, you know, I think the Fed has kind of taken the stance that they're going to do, you know, not the bare minimum, but they're going to do as much as they possibly can to ensure that we get through this in whatever form or fashion that looks like, certainly with maybe without some of the businesses that, you know, have been challenged for so long, but to get through it. And the other side of that is that the Fed stepped in as well and continues to stress test banks. They continue to look at the financial system overall to make sure that we survive. And so we had results today on those bank stress tests. The Fed has now said we're going to do some more testing than what we originally talked about. We're going to change some of the assumptions we've made about what an unemployment looks like. And the good news, I think, from at least the initial round is that it looks like the banks are in pretty good shape. We had kind of thought that was the case. They had slowed down or paused entirely share buybacks, with the exception of one of the six big U.S. banks. All their dividends were in line with what the Fed expected. And so, you know, I think as you look at kind of what the Fed has done from a consumer standpoint, from a supporting small businesses standpoint, you know, we certainly will be dealing with the after effects of that for a very long time. I think the important thing that we've seen, though, is that the Fed has stepped in to ensure that at least the financial system is going to survive.
Well, Kyle, I think it's important to note that broadly banks are well capitalized, but a lot of that is due to the fallout from the global financial crisis. And so here we are living through a period that's obviously going to be quite stressful. The financial sector has been hit hard. Obviously, rates are very low. The yield curve is essentially flat. How do banks make money? And when the Fed steps in and they realize that, okay, hey, everything we've done in the last 10 years is, for the most part, working, and banks are well capitalized, I think that's a good news story at the end of the day.
Yeah, I wonder if you guys, I just wonder what you think about this, but I think the the counterpoint to that, I guess, Steve, the part of it that I'm concerned about is, and I'm sure you guys anecdotally have similar stories, but I've had conversations with a number of companies who, you know, if you look and there's a virus, a vaccination down the road, and you can kind of look ahead and do the math and contemplate how much you might lose through this period, and you measure that against the stimulus you've gotten, and in many cases, people are actually ahead, you know. And then it makes me wonder if and again, I can't stress that I appreciate that the Fed has done everything it can to keep this thing going, because it could have gotten pretty ugly. But I wonder what the ramifications are on the back end of this thing in terms of how do we get the money back out of the system? And is, you know, it's the old law of unintended consequences. Are there things out there that will happen that we aren't fully appreciating right now as a result of that, you know? And that, too, is one of the things I think we'll be paying close attention to in the months and years ahead.
And, Brian, that's certainly, I think, a fair consideration, and one that longer term probably weighs on economic growth, longer term probably weighs on kind of how we navigate the next crisis as well. And so I think, you know, the further beyond kind of the middle of this crisis that we can get, the more important those conversations are going to be.
You know, and I think if you marry those two conversations, Kyle, and what do I know, but if you look ahead and you say, well, maybe there's less government money to support things, but I've saved more money on my own, maybe that's how things balance out in the long run. Yeah,
for sure. Steve, you talk to a lot more clients than I do. I have had a few conversations this week with clients where they were surprised at how good their statements actually looked. You know, you look at May end in particular, and with the end of the second quarter now coming up, we're on pace for potentially, and again, still two trading days left here, but on pace for potentially the best quarter we've had in 10 years. That's going to surprise some clients, given all the bad news we've talked about, you know, on the show today so far, all kind of the uncertainty that's out there. For clients to see a statement that even if we have a bad Monday and Tuesday next week, is going to be meaningfully positive, I think that's going to catch a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, Kyle, and it's a reminder of how important a well-balanced portfolio is. Investors continue to be surprised at their year-to-date returns on bond funds. As we all know, bond funds traditionally will move in the inverse of stock funds. So they have helped to offset some of the negatives we've seen on the stock side. But conversely, it's also an important reminder for time horizon. Those investors that have been worried about distributions, worried about meeting cash flow, recognizing that this volatility they're seeing in the stock side, as much as it has recovered, it still is money they know they don't need this year or next year or even for the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So it's comforting that with as much money as they have a set aside in fixed income to meet their cash flow needs, that they can still sleep easy.
Kyle, I'm just giving quarterly results from here on out for a while to my clients.
Yeah, I like to quote the rolling one-year number. Which, you know, I think is fair. It is always amazing to me when we have conversations with clients, or even when we have conversations internally about how, you know, we as investors like to high watermark everything, or we like to pick a clean date to say, this is what it was supposed to be. This is what my portfolio was supposed to look like. And I think the reality is far different. You know, you think of, you know, the grandfather clock that so many of us had in our houses growing up, and the pendulum that swings back and forth. And the right place for the pendulum isn't all the way over on one side or all the way over on the other. It's, you know, right down the middle where it belongs. And so I think, you know, you look at your portfolio and you go, yeah, we got way, way ahead of ourselves. And then maybe we came back a little bit too much the other direction. But if you measure it over long enough periods of time, and Steve, I think that's where that time horizon conversation becomes so important, and where really having a long-term view becomes so important. If you measure it over a long enough period of time, you start to smooth out those big swings. You start to say, okay, yeah, let's look at the last quarter, not at the last week. Let's look at the rolling 1 year, not the year to date, because I think then we start to smooth out a lot of, you know, kind of that day-to-day, week-to-week uncertainty.
Wouldn't it be funny, you guys, I've been doing this a long time, but if you were to not have had any context of what was going on in the last year, and you sat down and showed somebody 12-month numbers and 3-month numbers, I can't ever think of a time perhaps in my career where the story would have been so disparate from what the data would have suggested, right? So interesting. Interesting times for sure.
Well, that's the crazy part about this sell-off, Brian. We saw in a course of 3 weeks, a 45% decline on the market. Even the financial crisis where the markets pulled back 55%, it still took a year and a half. And right. So the velocity right. of that downdraft, I think, caught everybody by surprise. And as much as we've had investors with us for decades, and they can remember the tech crash in 2000, they can remember the meltdown from the global financial crisis in 07, this one was a little bit different for the speed at which it happened.
For sure.
And so I think a stark reminder for investors that, you know, you've got to have the long-term view. You've got to understand that even in the midst of some of the worst uncertainty that we've seen in a very long time for investors, you can have some really good days. You can have some really good weeks. You can even have some really good quarters. And so it's important to stay invested. It's important to remember, you know, why you have what you have in your portfolio. And ultimately, I think, you know, it's important to think long-term about what it is you're doing.
Amen.
Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.